I've come along to Knapp Hill Methodist Church and I'm meeting Rob Gill here, who is a member of the community. Thank you for giving your time to us here at Radio Woking, Rob.
My pleasure.
Lovely to meet you and to come into this church here in Knapp Hill. Now, you've got an exhibition on over the Easter weekend, which is celebrating 150 years of the Methodist Church being in Knapp Hill itself. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Not this church. In fact, this church only dates from the 1930s.
Okay.
The Methodists first showed up in Knapp Hill in late 1865, early 1866, we think.
Mm-hmm. And so it's not all that long ago, really, is it, when you think about it?
Well, 150 years, it sort of depends on your perspective, doesn't it?
True.
If you're in America, 150 years would be regarded as quite historic, but yeah, here, maybe not so. But in fact, I believe it was the first church in Knapp Hill. Certainly the Anglican church was later, and I believe the Baptist church was later. You have to understand that if we go back to 1865, frankly there wasn't much to Knapp Hill. I'm sure we'll talk a bit about what caused Knapp Hill to explode in the way it did, but really prior to about 1850-1860, my understanding is that this was common land. Mm-hmm. And there were some nurseries. I think the nurseries had started in the late 18th century, and there were some brickworks whose trade was no doubt spurred on by the building of the Basingstoke Canal, which
right,
I think was
yes.
The late 1780s, early 1790s. But really, the population in the early part of the 19th century hereabouts was frankly quite small,
yeah.
and I think because of that, there wouldn't have been a church here.
Right. Gosh, so then in that case, obviously the Methodist Church has been a fundamental part of the history of the village itself then.
That's right, and that's why we decided, as part of our 150th anniversary celebrations, when we were planning this exhibition, we decided that we couldn't really tell the story of the church without telling something of the story of the village as well.
Mm.
And we'll walk around the exhibition in a few moments, I'm sure, but the two are inextricably linked.
Mm.
Really, the Methodists really set foot here just at the time when Knapp Hill was starting to take off as a community of its own.
Mm. Right. And when we think of Methodist or Methodism itself, which part of the country was its kind of stronghold?
John Wesley, who is the founder of Methodism, was an inveterate traveller. By modern standards, maybe 250,000 miles travelled over a lifetime doesn't sound that much, but when you consider that Wesley travelled that distance on horseback, you'd hesitate to call them roads a lot of the time, they were just tracks.
Mm.
Phenomenal amount of travelling, and he really did cover the length and breadth of not only Britain but also Ireland as well. So really, by the time of his death, it's fair to say that Methodism had penetrated all of the main centres of population across the country, with its headquarters, I suppose, in London. Methodism certainly by the time of his death had really spread all over.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking actually of the Channel Islands, because my parents lived in Guernsey for a while, and it's very strong there for sure.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Yeah. And Wesley himself, I mean, as a younger man, he actually travelled to America. He was in Georgia for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
He was willing to go wherever he felt God sent him to spread the gospel.
Mm. And what were the sort of fundamental precepts that made his preaching different from anyone else around at the time?
Wesley was a Church of England vicar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think had he had his own way, he would have remained a Church of England vicar
right
until his death. But he was more or less forced out of the Church of England because they disagreed with some of his methods. And Wesley, I think, was labelled as an enthusiast in his lifetime, and that was a bad thing. That wasn't a good thing. To be an enthusiast was regarded as a black mark rather than something to be proud of. And I suppose really, one of the things which set him apart from the Church of England was that he decided that the only way to reach the working classes in particular was to preach in the open air.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really quite a radical departure from what the Church of England was doing at the time. The Church of England expected the parishioners to come to worship in the local parish church. A lot of them didn't. And Wesley felt very strongly that God's grace was available to all, not just to those who set foot inside a church. And the Church of England certainly objected to that. But it was, I think, you know, part of his genius that he saw that that was the way to reach out to people.
Well, yes, I'm thinking that for many people, they would have had to have travelled quite some distance to get to a local church, presumably, and therefore he was bringing the preaching to them rather than that expectation.
Yes, absolutely. And in some cases, probably some of the poorer people really did not feel welcome in an Anglican church. I mean, he had tremendous impact on the miners around Bristol, for example. Rough people, poor people, you know, working in tremendously hard conditions. I think through his preaching, which was by all accounts very direct, he managed to touch a lot of people and you know, brought them to faith in Christ. And you know, the opposition he faced in the early days was very considerable. Very often he was a subject of physical attacks,
right.
had to escape, you know, very rapidly because people really took strong exception to his methods, if not to his message.
I suppose then he was coming across as an egalitarian, very independent of the church itself, and that in itself would make waves.
He didn't want to be independent of the church. I mean, Wesley, I think by character, was quite a conservative man. He was not seeking any kind of break with the Church of England. I think he would say that actually it was the Church of England which broke with him rather than the other way around. And gradually, Methodism became a denomination in its own right by the time of his death. But I don't think that was something he ever really sought. I think, you know, it was just something that force of circumstances created. Egalitarian, I mean, he certainly, as I say, believed that God's grace was available to all people, whatever their rank, whatever their status. And I think that really made an impact on people. I mean, there is an argument, and I'm not a historian, so I can't really say very much about this, but there is an argument that through Wesley's work, particularly with poorer people, it was that which prevented a revolution in Britain, similar to the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century, because of the way he emancipated a lot of the poor through his you know, preaching and also for the social work. I mean, Wesley wasn't just a preacher, he was also a supreme organiser as well, and that was undoubtedly part of the man's talent, was that wherever he preached, he always tried to leave behind him a structure and an organisation which would care for these new Christians. People that were convinced by his preaching would become members of local Methodist societies, and they would be given a ticket every quarter to prove that they were members of a Methodist society. And then within the Methodist society, converts would be divided amongst so-called classes of about 10 or 12 people. And that the class was something that Wesley had borrowed, I believe, from the Moravian Church in Germany. And it's somewhat similar, if you will, to a Christian house group these days. It's where there would be fellowship and care and prayer and Bible study. And So Wesley wasn't just a hit and run kind of guy, you know, sort of turn up, preach, and then ride off on horseback. He always tried to leave behind him an organisation and a structure which would encourage new Christians in the faith. And you know, by all accounts, that was really very successful.
Yes, I can imagine. And it's funny because when you mentioned the word class, I was thinking of sort of the hierarchy that perhaps was very present in the Anglican Church at the time. Certainly my thoughts about the Catholic Church are quite hierarchical. Obviously what you're saying when you said class was nothing to do with that whatsoever.
No,
you're talking about meeting groups and really continuing debate, I suppose, was it?
It was certainly teaching.
Yeah.
And as I say, Bible study, and and I'm sure that people would have discussed the biblical texts. They would have studied Wesley's sermons. I mean, Wesley preached, I think, over 40,000 sermons in his lifetime, a lot of which are still available. I'm sure that there would have been a lot of discussion. Maybe not in the way that we would discuss today, maybe not as freely as that, but certainly it was an opportunity for Christians to grow in the faith. There is in the exhibition an example of one of the class tickets, actually. So it would be signed by the person in charge of the local Methodist Society. And I believe that at certain meetings, members would have actually had to show the ticket gain access.
Yes.
The other thing about Wesley was he really did care for the whole person. If we walk around the exhibition, I'll show you some of what Wesley had to say about things like diet and healthcare.
Interesting.
And a lot of it is still very modern. So, for example, you'll see what he had to say about the benefits of eating vegetables and the benefits of drinking water. Although this is over 250 years ago, I mean, a lot of it is still very contemporary. A fascinating man, really. Huge energy, of course, and stamina. I think actually one of the greatest Britons. And maybe when I take you around the exhibition, I'll show you a few examples of the China figures of Wesley that were made in the 19th century. There was a real cult of Wesley after his death in the 19th century.
Yeah.
Methodists counted their numbers in millions, and every Methodist home would have had probably one or several of these figures or busts of Wesley. It's difficult now maybe to understand quite the impact he had on society in the 18th century, but it was profound, there's no doubt about it. And I should mention as well that in all things he was very ably supported by his brother Charles. Charles was younger than John. But Charles was fired with the same zeal as John. John was very much the leader, but Charles was really the music maker of the two.
Yeah.
Charles, in his lifetime, wrote over 6,000 hymns. And many of them are still sung today. Probably one of the best known is Herald Angels Sing. But, there are lots of others which are still well known today. And there's no doubt that one of the key features of Methodism then and now is singing. Methodism, it has been said, was born in song. From the beginnings, people sang their faith, and we still do today.
How lovely.
Yes, yeah. And it's if you enjoy singing, and if you enjoy hymn singing, then a Methodist church is a good place to practice that.
And also something very healthy to do as well, of course.
Good for the lungs.
Indeed, yeah. So shall we go through to the exhibition? So we're now entering what is the main hall here, where the exhibition is. Quite a few people here, which is great to see. So Rob, where shall we start?
Well, the exhibition has got five sections. When we started thinking about planning the exhibition, we were thinking maybe that we would just tell the history of this local church. But then we decided that whilst that would be fascinating for us, it was a bit inward.
Right,
so
yes,
we wanted to actually, as far as possible, create an exhibition which would have interest to people who maybe know nothing about Methodism, maybe people who've moved to the area in the last 20 years or so and don't know a lot about the history of Knaphill.
Mm.
And also we wanted to showcase some of the organisations that are associated with the church as well. So the first part of the exhibition is what we call Knaphill 1865 and After. And we were talking earlier about the way Knaphill suddenly expanded in the middle of the 19th century. There were really two reasons for the growth of Knaphill. One was the coming of the railways.
Yes, of course, yes.
So the line between London and Southampton was opened between, I think, 1834 and 1840. And the other big factor in the growth of Knaphill was a number of cholera outbreaks in London.
Right.
And what was happening was that a lot of the churchyards in London were getting full, and they were running out of space to bury the dead.
Mm.
And in the 1850s, a company was formed called the London Necropolis Company, which was formed by Act of Parliament and bought 20,000 acres of land from Lord Onslow, southwest of Woking. And the purpose of the London Necropolis Company was to provide burial places, not just for the overflow of London dead, but I believe at one time at least their plan was that everywhere nationally should be buried in this area.
Yeah.
So they bought what became Brookwood Cemetery, but in fact an area much larger than merely Brookwood Cemetery, and created a railway line off the London Southampton line to run actually into the cemetery, traces of which can still be seen today. My understanding is that quite quickly the company ran into financial difficulties and it had to start selling off parcels of land to keep afloat.
Yeah.
And in about 1860, two institutions were created in the vicinity, having bought land from the London Necropolis Company. One was what was known as Brookwood Lunatic Asylum at the time, and the other was a prison, which the prison stood on land very close to what is now Winston Churchill School, where you broadcast from.
Yes, yes.
Both of these institutions needed labour, and of course that attracted a lot of people to the area, quite apart from the fact that within a short space of time there were a lot of people actually inhabiting both the asylum and the prison. And in fact, this is an interesting statistic here, Sharon. In 1871, this is an extract from the Knaphill census, there were 4,300 or so people living in Knaphill. Over half of them were living in institutions,
either the asylum
or the prison.
So you almost had to be mad, bad or dead to be here, really.
So it's a very, very good way of putting it. And it was really those two institutions which drove the growth of Knaphill, as I understand it. The prison survived until 1895, when it was handed over to the army, which used it as a barracks well into the 20th century. The hospital survived until the 1990s.
Yes, I remember it myself, yes.
We've got some photographs here of what the hospital used to look like. I'll refer you to this, which is quite an interesting exhibit. This is a costume which would have been worn by the inmates at the hospital, and it's called a strong dress, worn both by men and women, as I understand it. And you'll see that it's made of moleskin, quite thick, padded, and it's an indication of how progressive the methods of care were at the time compared to the straitjackets and the awful conditions in which so-called lunatics would have been living previously. In the strong dress, patients could move, but by the same token they were at much less risk of harming themselves or other people, because they couldn't rip the strong dress, and because it was padded, I mean, if they were anxious and were hurling themselves around, there was much less risk of them hurting themselves. And I think right from the beginning, the hospital prided itself on its human methods. The other interesting thing is just how self-sufficient the hospital was. I didn't realise this until we started researching the exhibition, but the hospital had its own farm, 140-acre farm.
Right.
It had its own fire brigade, and there's a picture of the old pub. Here and had its own sewage disposal works. It really was a community
unto
all of
itself,
its own.
Yes,
really,
yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So,
because when you think, I mean, the site, although it's mainly housing and a supermarket now, is still quite a large area that you're very aware of.
Yeah.
You know, that having been the space for the hospital.
Exactly. So, obviously, we can't really do full justice to the history of Knaphill, but I think the point that we want to make is that although to the casual observer Knaphill may have very little of a historic interest, you might dismiss it as a rather bland suburb of Woking. In fact, if you're prepared to dig a bit, there's an awful lot of history of the last 150 years, which makes it in some ways a unique community.
Definitely. Oh, I shall not drive through without being much more aware now, that's for sure.
So that's the first section of the exhibition, and then we move on to the second section of the exhibition, which we've called our Methodist Heritage. And really the purpose of this part of the exhibition is to try and explain to people who are not familiar with Methodist history at all something of what Methodism is, some of the things that we've been talking about already today. If we move over here... we've got some of Wesley's words, for example, on well-being. He says, "Water is the wholesomest of all drinks, quickens the appetite and strengthens the digestion most."
I have to say, I totally agree. I drink mainly water.
And then this one, "We may strengthen any weak part of the body by constant exercise. Thus the lungs may be strengthened by loud speaking or walking up an easy ascent. The digestion and the nerves by riding. The arms and hands by strongly rubbing them daily."
Right. Sounds like good advice. And also about food as well here.
Exactly, yes. "For studious persons, about 8 ounces of animal food and 12 ounces of vegetable in 24 hours.
Sound advice, as you say. Yes, yes. More and more of us are turning to vegetarianism and veganism even.
Yes, exactly. A modern man in some ways, or even though, you know, we're going back to the 18th century. And then we were talking a bit about the cult of Wesley in the 19th century, and we've got some items on display over here. Some items of China, some figures of Wesley, busts of Wesley, one of him preaching with a little clock underneath.
Yeah.
We borrowed these from Westminster Central Hall, which is one of the big Methodist halls in London. And there's a few paintings of him, one in extreme old age. He lived till he was 88, which was a remarkable age for the 18th century.
So his advice was obviously good, to drink water and eat, you know, sensibly.
Yes.
Kept him going, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by the time of his death, I mean, he had created a separate Methodist denomination, however reluctantly, and certainly by the time of his death, Methodism was already starting to be implanted in the States as well. He sent preachers over to the US, and they were doing the work of Methodism over there as well, particularly on the eastern seaboard. And actually over here we've got a map showing the distribution of Methodists around the world today. And as you can see, it really has spread far and wide. The States is still very strong. Parts of Europe, maybe surprisingly. One of the big strongholds of Methodism today is South Korea. A lot of Methodists there, but pretty widespread over Asia.
Yeah.
And parts of Africa as well.
And also what we would have considered Eastern Europe,
yes,
too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Worldwide, I mean, it depends quite how you count it, but there's probably about 75 million Methodists. I have heard it said that that makes it the world's largest Protestant denomination, whether that's right or not. But, I mean, it's certainly there are a lot of people around the world who, you know, in terms of their faith, would sort of trace their history back to John Wesley.
Gosh. Yes, that's quite impressive, that map, isn't it?
It is.
It really is.
Yes.
The influence that one person can have always just astounds me. I mean, when people say, oh, there's nothing I can do about something, when you have that zeal and enthusiasm,
yes,
it's amazing what can be achieved, isn't it?
Exactly. And maybe in the 18th century it was still possible to be a sort of Renaissance man, that's to say, you know, they didn't sort of confine themselves just to religion or, you know, just to another area of life. I mean, the Wesley brothers were fascinated by science as well, some of the scientific discoveries in the 18th century. Charles Wesley was very interested in medicine and he had his own dispensary. At that period, people, I think, still felt that they could command all that there was to know. Whereas, of course, today we think ourselves lucky if we know a lot about a little.
Indeed, but then I think we've also compartmentalised life a lot, and perhaps the idea of the holistic vision, you know, it's time for it to rise again, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Well, I think so, anyway.
Yes. So we're moving around now to the third section, which we called Knaphill Methodism down the years. Obviously, we would have upset our own local Methodists a lot had we not included some of the local memorabilia,
sure,
in the exhibition,
yes,
as well.
Yes.
So down this side, you can see we've got some interesting old documents, actually, which sort of relate to Knaphill and the local area. I mentioned to you the system of class tickets, and you can see some little class tickets here. Those are relatively recent. They date from the 1950s. But I want to draw your attention to this document, which I was really excited to come across. This document dates from 1904. And the Methodist ministry was always considered, and I think is still considered, to be an itinerant ministry. That's to say that the clergy wouldn't just minister to a local congregation, they would minister to a larger area. And Methodism is organised into so-called circuits, which are groupings of churches in a particular area, and the clergy would have oversight over perhaps two or three, maybe more, churches in a particular area. And this document, as I say, dates from 1904 and is what's called the circuit plan. So basically this was like a timetable showing the times of all the services at the various churches the area, and the names of the times of the services, and the names of the preachers that were in the locality that would be sent to each church. So you can see at this time there were four churches in the circuit: Woking, Knaphill, Byfleet, and Ripley. And then there was a weekday, an occasional service at West End by Chobham as well. So I think this is quite a precious document. And what's interesting is that the system of the quarterly circuit plan still survives.
Excellent.
Really hasn't changed very much in
120
years, although the names have changed, of course.
Lovely.
We were delighted to find that document.
Yeah. So you know exactly who was preaching in the area at the time.
Yes, exactly.
And this idea of sort of covering a circuit, so not being necessarily linked with one particular church for years on end, was that also perhaps about, I don't know, a sort of non-hierarchical idea that someone couldn't get too fixed with one community? Or
It's certainly true that in the early days, I mean, ministers would get rotated around very frequently, and even now Methodist ministers rotate. I think typically a Methodist minister will be invited for a period of 5 years.
Okay.
Now, if the minister and the congregation want that invitation can be extended for a further period of years. But I think, you know, there is still something of the flavour of the itinerant ministry about it. No man or woman can expect to go to a church and be there for the rest of their lives. That's not how it works.
I'm guessing in some respects, although that familiarity can be very favourable in that you build relations with your community, you know exactly what's going on the other hand, it's nice to have that freshness as well of moving to another area and, you know, finding out what's going on there.
Yes, and I think certainly the Methodist connection would say that it provides a variety of experience both for the minister and for the congregation, and certainly the way the circuits run nowadays, there would be a variety of preachers in leading worship in a particular church, because you've got the ministers of the circuit. But another thing I should have said is that a very strong feature of Methodism from the early days was the involvement, the active involvement of lay people. You've mentioned the word hierarchical, and I suppose that's another example of the way in which the Methodist Church is maybe less hierarchical, in that the lay people are encouraged, indeed necessarily play a significant part in the work of the church, and indeed in the leading of worship as well.
So in a sense, that's sort of giving them not just the familiarity but the sense of belonging, and I don't like to use the word ownership, but in a sense, the ownership of your community.
Absolutely. The lay folk have to bear a lot of the burden. And that encourages commitment and dedication. And I think the Methodist Church has been very well served by its lay folk over the last 200 and odd years.
Well, hopefully they don't all see it as a burden, though.
A joyful burden.
Of course, yes.
So we're walking now past a lot of photographs of local church events over the years. And what I think is striking is, certainly if you go back maybe to the early part of the 20th century, just how all-encompassing the church was at that time. It wasn't just where you went once a week to worship God. Your whole social life revolved around the church. So, for example, here we have a picture of the Napier Methodist cricket team in 1929.
Excellent, yeah.
And you can also see various photos of dramatic performances being put on. Outings, church outings. Really, outside work, the church, for those that belong to it, was all-encompassing. Every part of your life was catered for by the church. And phenomenal numbers. I mean, you know, the Sunday school alone at times would number 300 or 400 children.
Goodness me. Yes, that is a lot, isn't it?
Just huge. It's difficult to understand the impact of the church on society in those days.
Yeah,
in fact,
this
church actually first started the first day school in the village. It was quite quickly taken over by the Surrey Education Authorities, but for a year or two, I think in about 1867, 1868, the church was actually providing the first primary education.
That's fabulous, isn't it? Well, I'm looking at some photos here from the year of my birth. I won't say which year it is. It's certainly not 1860s anyway, thankfully, but that's fascinating. Lots of smiling faces in all of these photos. They're obviously all enjoying all the different activities.
Yeah, music would have been a large part of the life, of course, and drama.
Yeah, you've got a leaflet there, Garden Frivolities. That sounds exciting.
Absolutely. That was 1946. And as you can see, you know, performances by members of the congregation.
Yeah.
Everybody had to have a party piece, of course, in those days.
Just loving the words. Another frolic. Yes, brilliant.
Yeah.
Nothing like a good frolic. Excellent. A Christmas fair. 100 years of education in Knapp Hill. I mean, lots of newspaper cuttings and things. I mean, you could spend hours in here, obviously.
Yeah, and indeed, some people have. I mean, it's been great, actually, to see how much time some people have spent just looking.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, of course, it reawakens many memories. It's very interesting for maybe people who moved away and have come back to visit the exhibition who were here when they were younger. You know, they really start reminiscing and it sort of triggers memories of what they did in their youth. And that's fantastic, actually. As I've said in the programme, we don't do history for its own sake. I think we do history also because it helps us to understand the present and indeed to set our course for the future as Christians and as human beings, actually. It's really important that we remember our roots. And for people that, you know, have their roots in this church or in Methodism or indeed just in the village, to come in and sort of see reminders of things that they remembered, it's great, actually. We've had some fantastic conversations over the weekend, actually.
I bet you have, actually. Just looking at these photos, I can imagine. Just that the ideas and thoughts that it would trigger in people. Hopefully they've written some things down for you as well.
Yes. Well, we've got a visitor's book in the corner, and lots of people have written in that, which is good.
Yeah.
Can I perhaps show you something about the history of the church?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a picture here of the original church. Within a couple of years of the Methodists arriving in 1865, incidentally, the reason they came originally was because it was reported that some of the workmen, or maybe some of the warders at the prison, were playing cricket on a Sunday, which of course was a dreadful sin. So that's what first caused the Methodists to come up from Guildford to evangelise and try and sort of show them the error of their ways. And within a couple of years, from classic open air preaching, they moved into a pub. In fact, a couple of pubs, we think. Maybe the Royal Standard, which used to be on Anchor Hill, and then the Royal Oak, which is still there at the bottom of Anchor Hill. And then, as I say, within a couple of years, they graduated to their own church. I mean, it went at breakneck speed, really. And this is a picture of the original Flint Church, which dates from 1867. That church survived until 1935, when it was considered unsafe. So they had to knock it down.
It's rather a pretty building, actually.
Yes, and unfortunately, there aren't many photographs of the church still in existence, at least not that we've been able to find. But I think they decided in the 1930s it was just going to be too costly to try and renovate.
Mm. And I'm interested, because you've called the exhibition partly about sort of from pub to
pulpit.
Yes. And when you think about, you know, you mentioned that there was this idea of drinking water and all the rest. A pub seems a rather bizarre place to sort of meet.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because one of the things that people who are maybe not familiar with Methodism, the one thing they do know about Methodism, or at least they think they know about Methodism, Methodists don't touch alcohol. And yet, ironically, you know, the first first organised meetings of the Methodist Society here were in a pub.
There you go.
So then we move on to the present church, which was constructed again very rapidly actually in 1935, and it was actually the gift of a member of the church, a Mr. Frank Derry. There's a picture of him here. He actually provided the funds for the church. Mr. Derry was a local businessman who had made his fortune developing a corset complete with magnetic ribs to help cure rheumatism.
Goodness me! There you go.
And it was his money which enabled the church to be built. And that's, you know, the church we're still worshipping in today.
Yeah. Gosh, how amazing, isn't it? So developing the corset helped to build the church.
Yes.
And yet it sounds like the actual sort of Methodism hasn't really got that quality of being in a corset or a straitjacket in any way at all.
No, I mean, I think, well, it's an interesting way of putting it. Methodism tries to be a broad church. Some people will use service books every week in their services. Other people, you'll have a hymn book, but maybe nothing, no other kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Methodism does vary from place to place. But I think I would say the Methodist emphasis has always tried to be on God's love shown through Jesus, who died to show us the depths of God's love, and that love is freely available to all who seek. And in fact, we can even know that we are saved, to put it in the Wesleyan language. That's what I'm not a Methodist by origin, but it's what's always a number of things have attracted me to Methodism through the years. One is, as we were talking about, the ability for the lay folk to get really heavily involved in the work of the church. The outreach of the Methodist Church has always been a very strong feature of Methodism, and then I would say the work with youth as well has always been very good with the Methodist Church. There used to be an annual MAYC weekend in London, actually, and there's a bit of MAYC memorabilia over there, and basically MAYC stands for the Methodist Association of Youth Clubs.
Right.
And every year they would have a big meeting in London. They would take over the Albert Hall for the weekend, and maybe 16 or 17,000 youngsters would congregate in London for that. And a lot of older Methodists now will sort of, their eyes will moisten when you talk about NYC weekends, because they took part in them years and years ago. So yes, that's always been a feature of Methodism.
So it sounds like it's very much sort of by thy works you shall be known, in a sense.
Yes, I mean, not in a showy-offy way, but I mean, Wesley, really right from the time that he was at Oxford and becoming ordained, he was unusual in that he went very regularly to Oxford Jail to visit the inmates, to visit the prisoners and sort of do what he could for them and their families. So that sort of social dimension has always been part of Methodism's DNA. And in a more local way, I mean, one of the things this church does is support the work of the Whitechapel Mission in London. So the Whitechapel Mission is a Methodist church, but it has a particular responsibility looking after the homeless in the East End of London. It's a fantastic place, and members of this church have gone up to Whitechapel to actually help with some of the tasks that need to be done, sort of helping with washing and feeding these homeless people. We support them materially as well. We provide gifts of food and clothing and bedding and so on. And I think that is a key part of what being a Christian is, caring for your neighbour,
yes,
particularly those
indeed.
Who are more disadvantaged.
Yes, linking up to humanity and in all of its aspects, really, rather than judging.
Yes. So, two more parts of the exhibition. One is a bit of a showcase of some of the organisations that use our premises week in, week out. I mean, we regard this as part of our sort of community service as well, providing a home for people like the Bisley Ladies Choir, the Cactus Club, Jenny Reed School of Dance, the uniformed organisations, guides and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a playgroup here which meets four mornings a week. So the premises are well used.
Yes. Well, it does sound like it's a really vibrant community.
Yeah. And then just in the corner here, there's a bit of a display as to what we might do with the church going forward. We've had an architect draw up some plans for us as to how we might reconfigure the actual church itself.
Uh-huh.
These are very much at the discussion stage. Nothing has been decided as yet. But as you can see, Sharon, the mock-up of what the front of the church might look like if we decided to go ahead, it really looks quite attractive and much more open to the Broadway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the key features of this is that it would provide level access from the Broadway. At the moment, there's a set of steps which have to be surmounted, which isn't good for people who maybe not got great mobility.
Yes.
So that would be a fantastic thing if we could actually provide level access at the front.
Oh, definitely. And the drawing that you have there is a nice glass frontage, which, as you say, looks very open and welcoming, doesn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Gosh, so that's future plans, what, next 5 or so years? Or?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, we have to decide if that's what we want to do. And then I'm sure there'll be a very intensive period of fundraising.
Yes, indeed.
So, yes, I mean, it's medium term, I would say. It's not going to happen in the next few weeks. But exciting plans.
Yes.
And it would also give us the opportunity to modernise the worship area a bit. I mean, obviously, as with any project or proposal of this kind, you get a variety of opinions. I mean, some people will say that they love the Art Deco features of the actual church and wouldn't want to see those sacrificed as part of any redevelopment. So it's important that we consult, and indeed one of the purposes of having this display as part of the exhibition is to give an opportunity for people to give their views, because we regard this not just as an asset for the church community but for the wider village community as well. So it's important that everybody has a chance to have their say about what they think should be done.
And obviously if they welcome it, then that's a positive for everybody, as you say. Now, sadly, this exhibition finishes today. I'm here on Monday. So people haven't got the chance to come and see once this is broadcast, but presumably these plans are available publicly, are they?
Yes, the plans, if anybody's interested in seeing them, we're very happy to share them. As I say, we're interested in as wide a range of views as possible. The other thing I would say is that the exhibition is only part of a year-long series of anniversary celebrations. So today may be the end of the exhibition, but it's certainly not the end of the anniversary celebrations.
Brilliant, I'm glad to hear that.
And the next major event is the weekend of the 11th and 12th of June, where we're having a flower festival in church, a community flower festival. We're inviting all local organisations that want to participate to contribute floral displays. And we're also inviting back that weekend former members of the church, people who've had an association with the church in the past who'd like to come back for service, or both services on the Sunday. And what we're hoping to do is hopefully recreate some of the elements of this exhibition for that weekend.
Good. Yeah, that would be lovely.
Yeah.
Because it's certainly fascinating. As I say, I could certainly spend hours in here. And although you've had quite a few people come through, I'm sure, you know, lots of people would be sad to have missed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting if you read the visitors' book. One of the comments in the visitors' book is to the effect that they say how great it is that at last we've got a local museum in Nashville, which is very flattering, but I'm afraid it is just a temporary exhibition.
Well, it shows what a good job you've done, though. So, yes, well done. Rob, I want to thank you for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you and also to learn more about the Methodist Church here and, well, the village itself as well. So I hope that you will keep me informed of what's going on and perhaps come on the programme again.
I'd love to, Sean. Thank you ever so much for having us.
Thank you.